Welcome again to the Ask Beattie Show. And isn't it the truth, my friends? We all go through so many ups and downs and detours and challenges in our life. And when we begin to feel that we are on a never-ending merry-go-round ride or a roller coaster ride, and the rides are no longer feeling like fun, we have a couple of options. We can continue on the ride, and of course, we know what happens if we do the same old thing. We're going to get the same old results. Or we can make a decision. We can make a decision that perhaps we could benefit from getting some help, from getting a second opinion, a second perspective. And I think that so many people, when they think about therapy, they think about maybe lying on a couch, and they may also think that they are going to be in therapy if they decide to begin therapy for years and years. And although some people are in therapy for a very, very long time, what I have found over the years, and I've been now practicing for over 35 years, and every single week when I say that, I can hardly believe the fact that I graduated from McGill University with my master's degree in clinical social work, and then I did my postgraduate degrees in marriage and family therapy and sexual dysfunction so many years ago. But for me, this has been a love and my passion, even though at times, of course, the patients that I see, I've had some very, very, very challenging situations over the years. But, you know, the good news is that if people are really serious, and of course, serious, I underscore that word every single week, about really acknowledging, addressing, and resolving their issues with a really good therapist. And I have to also underscore that all therapists and all therapies are certainly not the same. And if you are actually thinking of going into therapy, please get a referral from somebody that you trust, and do not just go to the internet and look at the numbers of stars or the number of reviews, because bad therapy can be really, really damaging, and good therapy can really make all the difference in the world. So I hope that I convince you every single week that if that depression, it is just lingering, you exercise, you're eating better, and yet there is something that's really getting in the way of your life and your relationships on a day-to-day basis. Perhaps it's just some unfinished business, or what I call skeletons in the closet, stemming from family of origin issues. Perhaps you were somebody that was unlucky, like several of my patients who grew up in very, very abusive family situations, sexual abuse, physical abuse, verbal abuse, emotional abuse, and they're still working through all of those issues because they're feeling that they continue to have one foot in the past and one foot in the present. And I certainly don't want to suggest that people who grew up in very, very difficult circumstances, that all is going to be forgiven and all is going to be well. In fact, forgiveness is not part of what needs to happen, despite what a lot of people might tell you, for you to be able to really move on with your life. But there certainly is a way, and there's an effective way, to emotionally work through what did and did not happen, even though, of course, we cannot change our history. And, you know, as a reminder, I mean, depression is a huge mental health issue in the United States. I mean, there are 350 million people worldwide who are suffering from depression, 16 million adults in the United States, and that translates into 1 in 5 Americans, 40 million adults suffering from a variety of anxiety disorders. And of course, in this country, so many people, you know, talk about the quick fix. Let's just take another pill. In fact, I have a couple of patients who've been working with psychiatrists here in New York City for a very, very long time, and I have yet to be successful for these people to fire their doctors and get a second opinion. I mean, I have one woman who's on 15 different medications every single day, including 3 or 4 sleeping medications. I mean, really? And she walks around oftentimes in this very zombie-like state, and yet is very fearful of making the changes. And sometimes we can give our patients, sometimes we can give our friends, we can give our families the best possible advice, and yet we cannot change anyone. And that's something, if there's anything that I've learned over all these years, is that we can't change people. All we can do is we can encourage change. We can offer different perspectives and how they look at their lives and their relationships. And in the final analysis, people really do need to make a choice. Are they going to live their lives and do things that are really in their best interest? And of course, that's the homework that I give every single patient that walks through my office every single time when they're leaving. I want people to be really mindful about whether or not the behaviors that they are engaging in, the people who they are engaging in, their work situations, their financial situations, are truly things that are in our best interest. And I think that sometimes we all really have to pause and ask ourselves, is eating that huge piece of cake, okay, once in a while, that is not going to destroy us. But is eating that huge piece of cake and the meat and all the foods that absolutely are not in our best interest, that cause all kinds of inflammation? I mean, are to be aware, to be mindful of trying to live our lives in ways that are really constructive. And I think a lot of people, at least a lot of people that I see, are confused. They're not sure if a certain kind of a relationship is in their best interest, particularly. I mean, I tell the story, you know, of a young woman who I treated a number of years ago. And she was abused by her parents, her siblings. There was family sexual abuse. I mean, it was a horrendous, horrendous situation for the majority of her life. And when she started to work with me, I mean, to say that she was angry was an understatement. And it was perfectly, perfectly, you know, understandable. And as we started to work together, she was beginning to work through all of the horrors and the abuse that she sustained as a child. And one day she arrived in my office and she said, you know, Beattie, I've met this really terrific guy. And I was thrilled for her. She hadn't dated. She really avoided any kind of interaction with men, again, because of what had happened in her family. Her father physically abused her, sexually abused her. Her mother looked the other way. The brothers and the sisters were all involved in sexually abusing one another. Well, the parents continued to enable and encourage that kind of dysfunction and that kind of traumatic, traumatic behavior. So she meets this terrific man. And she starts to go out and she comes into my office and she's smiling and she's feeling good and she's feeling optimistic that maybe once in her life she's going to be able to finally have a really functional relationship with an adult male. So what do you think really happened? Well, as they continue to date, she arrives on another day for her appointment. She says, I've broke it off. And I said, what happened? You were so happy. Things were going so well. And that was the point, that things were going so well and it didn't feel right. It felt, in quotes, wrong. And I will never forget what she said to me on that particular day. She said, Beattie, how can something so good, so functional, so terrific feel so bad and so wrong? Because what was, in quotes, familiar to her during most of her life was abuse. So naturally, we had a lot more things that we needed to sort out. But if there is really a way, and if there is a will, there are amazing things that can happen in your life, in your relationship, whether or not you are suffering from depression, anxiety, a variety of different kinds of substance abuse, whether or not you're having sexual problems, whether or not you're having relationship problems. But again, it really does depend on you. You know, is it the time? Have you had enough of dysfunctional relationships, of unavailable men or unavailable women, or situations that simply don't work? Have you had enough of the substance abuse problems that you have been battling, or not really battling seriously, for all of these years? It's like, when is enough enough? And you know what I have felt over the years, and I've had a wish. I wish there was a way that I could push a button and really fast forward people's getting to a place where they were just no longer able to fall down further, because that is exactly what I have found as a therapist, as a sex therapist, is that when there is a little bit of pain, the majority of people will really not do much. So that we do have to, unfortunately, we have to sometimes really bottom out before we are willing to look at ourselves and not blame the world and our parents and our partners and our politics, and say to ourselves, okay, am I finally prepared to start to deal with my issues? Am I serious about actually doing the work? And until people really get to that point, there's very, very little that is actually going to change. Now, when we're talking about depression, and this is something that I mention every single week here on the Ask Beatty Show, is that studies are finding that almost any type of physical activity, whether strenuous or light, help to offset people's genetic propensity for depression, though the benefits were greater when people exercise more. We know this. We talk about this a lot. And how many people continue to make a lot of excuses about why they can't exercise? There isn't any time. It's too difficult. It's too cold. It's too hot. And depression is, of course, one of the world's most common mental health disorders, affecting more than 300 million people globally, according to the World Health Organization. And as we know, some people experience a single bout during their lives, and others unfortunately face repeated episodes. However, encouraging news, okay, that other research indicates that exercise may help fight the condition, and multiple large-scale epidemiological studies link high aerobic fitness with lower risk of depression. Well, experiments involving people with depression show that exercise often lessens the length or severity of their bouts. So if depression is something that is plaguing you, please, please get up from the computer and walk around the block or join a gym, and certainly think about seriously to get moving. And the studies, I mean, there are really so many studies that talk about a longer life, and that longer lives are certainly related to exercise and, of course, diet. You know, there was an article that I found that I wanted to just review with you very briefly. And of course, Gary Null talks about this every single day. And changing your diet can help tamp down depression and boost mood. And this was a 2019 study. And that the study found that depression symptoms dropped significantly. So please take this in. in a group of young adults who ate a Mediterranean style diet for 3 weeks. It's the latest study to show that food can influence mental health. There's fresh evidence that eating a healthy diet, one that includes plenty of fruits and vegetables and limits high processed foods, can help reduce symptoms of depression. And just to summarize this study for you, this was a randomized controlled trial published in the journal PLOS-1 that finds that the symptoms of depression drop significantly among a group of young adults after they followed a Mediterranean-style pattern of eating for just 3 weeks. That's interesting. And that participants saw their depression score fall from the moderate range down to the normal range, and they reported lower levels of anxiety and stress, too. And I know that Gary talks about this every day, and we really need to be serious about what we are putting into our mouths. And alternatively, the depression scores among the control group of participants who didn't change their diets didn't budge. So these participants continued to eat a diet high in refined carbohydrates and sugars and processed foods and beverages, and their depression scores remained in the moderate severity range. So researcher Heather Francis, who is a lecturer in clinical neuropsychology at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia, she told NPR that they were really quite surprised by the findings. And she said that, "I think the next step is to demonstrate the physiological mechanism underlying how diet can improve depression symptoms." So we have to be mindful of the people who we interact with. We want to avoid toxins, toxin people, toxin chemicals of every kind, and to make sure that we are having a really good diet and that we do exercise. And if that is not helping significantly enough, again, the next thing that you can certainly think about doing is reaching out and asking for help. And of course, we talk about the 75-year Harvard study that focuses on the one thing that is critical to long-term happiness. And of course, that is having fulfilling relationships. So we have to look at our relationships. We have to take a look at who stays, who goes, who we are going to try to work things out with, and to avoid toxic people under any circumstances at all. For me, and this is just me and my own personal ways of looking at things, I want zero toxicity in my life. And that does not mean that you don't try to work out difficulties and issues with people. But if you find that you try and you try, and that the poison remains in your relationships, you have to be serious about making a decision and get whatever help that you need to extricate and to exit all toxic relationships, because toxic people make us crazy. It affects us emotionally and psychologically and mentally and physically. So please, I hope that you really do take this in and take a really honest look at the people in your life. Well, I got a few emails over the weekend asking me to elaborate a little bit more about some of the patients who I treat. Well, yesterday was Sunday, and I have a really interesting practice. People come from all over the country to work with me, whether or not it's about sexual issues or couple issues or depression. So for me, working on a Sunday is not unusual. And it may be that on a Monday, I'll play tennis in the morning. I will host the Ask Beattie show in the afternoon. So my practice is a very open-ended, flexible schedule type of psychotherapy and sex therapy practice. And what I've been finding is that I've been getting a lot of calls from young women and also from young men. I mean, the young women is something that is really not new. The young men, meaning men under 30 or in their early 30s. So I want to tell you, and of course, I'm going to be changing a lot of the details to protect people's confidentiality and anonymity. So I get a call from a young man over the weekend, and he really also wanted to come in on Sunday and couldn't wait until Monday and Tuesday. So let's call him Bob. Bob is 29 years of age, highly educated, an attractive young man from, let's just say that he's from France. He's not from France, but I really want to make sure that his identifying information is not going to be able to be identified. And he told me that he was having some anxiety and that he was having some sexual difficulties. And, of course, I was interested specifically in his early childhood, and what he learned in his early childhood was that sex was bad, and it was something that you did not talk about, and it was also something that you really didn't do very much of. It was primarily for procreation. He grew up in a very... very strict Catholic family, went to Catholic school. And although, you know, when we were talking yesterday, he wasn't sure how much impact the discussions about sex really had on him. It was interesting that he went back to a number of conversations when he was a little boy when we were talking that made him really question whether or not he learned that sex was bad, that sex was wrong, that sex was embarrassing. So here was the story. He said that when he went to prostitutes, and he went to prostitutes in France because he felt that he did not have sufficient confidence sexually. So when he went to prostitutes, he said he learned a lot of things. He did not have any problems with erection and was feeling a lot more confident. He visited prostitutes probably 10 or 12 times and felt a really pretty good level of confidence. And this was when he was 20. So now he's 29. And he told me also that when he would have hookups with random women, he did not have any problems at all getting or maintaining an erection. He said he had some issues with premature ejaculation, but overall, his confidence level with random women was on a scale of 1 to 10. It was probably about a 7 or an 8. But then what was really interesting, he said, with the women who he had some interest in, who he hoped that perhaps they would be able to build some type of a relationship, that he simply was unable to get or maintain an erection under any circumstances at all. And he was very concerned about that. And a lot of his friends, apparently he was open with a number of his male friends, and they wondered whether or not he was gay. I asked him whether he was. He said that he was not. And that he also mentioned that he would drink, believe it or not, a bottle or two of alcohol before and during these sexual encounters. And of course, as we all know, that alcohol is a depressant and that it certainly can affect, you know, men and women's ability to be able to really experience the sensations of, you know, of sex. So I found out that he was an alcoholic, which he reluctantly agreed. And hopefully he is going to be returning, and we're going to try to figure out why it is with prostitutes and why it is with random women that his sexual performance was fine. and why it is and why it has been a real problem with women who he liked and women who he was hoping to have more than just a sexual connection with. And of course, the alcohol problem is a huge problem. And of course, when I, you know, confronted him about that, he said, "I know, but all my friends, we always drink this kind of amount of alcohol, and that's just the culture, and that's the way it is." And I asked him whether or not he was concerned about his liver, and I think at 29, he probably hadn't given his liver any thought whatsoever. So it's going to be interesting to see whether or not he returns. He said that he was going to, but he has certainly some work to do. And so some of the early messages that he received about sex, and obviously he's experiencing performance anxiety. And I think that maybe, you know, he's feeling that, you know, all men on a first or second date should be initiating and having sex. And perhaps, and I think with this particular young man, very sensitive, very smart, very educated, I think that he probably should, you know, moving forward, give himself permission to slow things down and to get to know the woman a little bit before feeling that he should be initiating sex. And I think that perhaps is, you know, might explain some of his anxiety, where he feels the shoulds that real men initiate and have sex on first dates or even before the first dates. And of course, that's a myth. So, you know, we spent an hour together. And as I say, I hope that he is going to be willing to really take more of an in-depth look into all of this, including his alcoholism moving forward. But again, you know, all I can do and all we can all do when you know, people are asking our advice, we can encourage, we can offer second opinions, different perspectives. But in the final analysis, people really need on their own to make the decision whether or not they are willing to look inward and whether or not they're willing to make any changes. And even more importantly, whether or not they are willing, really willing, to live their lives in a way that is truly in their best interest. I mean, if this man does not deal with his alcohol problem, you know, and I said to him, I said, you know what? I said, if I was going to be advising a woman who was wanting to date him and wanting to get to know him, and if she came back and told me that he was an alcoholic, I would never advise this woman to move forward with the relationship. Because I don't know about you, but I have treated many people who have substance abuse problems of various different kinds, and the last thing that you want is to have a partner who is an alcoholic or who is a drug abuser, who is unwilling to acknowledge, address, and resolve the issues. It plays havoc with your life, with your children's life, with your sex life, with your relationship. So this man has some things to think about, and I will update you about his progress if he chooses to come back and really continue in therapy. Then I had another interesting patient yesterday. Let's call him John. And John is 79 years old. He is spry. He is smart. He has a million different degrees. And John is bisexual. And he came in and he wanted my opinion about whether or not he should seriously consider getting a penile implant. All right. So a penile implant, I mean, this is a minor surgery. It's a minor surgical procedure. And of course, I asked him whether or not he had tried all of the other various things that men who are dealing with erectile dysfunction should actually be discussing and should be trying before ever considering surgery of any kind. So we went through everything. I asked him whether or not he had tried, you know, Viagra and Cialis and Levitra, and he said that he had. I mean, this is a pretty sophisticated man. I asked him whether or not he had tried the injections. He said, yes, he had. And these are all things, by the way, that if you are having any kind of issue in terms of ongoing erectile dysfunction, and by the way, every man, doesn't matter what their age is, from time to time will have some issues. But I'm talking about a chronic kind of a condition. So he tried injections. He tried the penis pump. He really tried everything. And he said, look, he said, physically, I'm not what I was. And he's working with a really top urologist here in New York City. And, you know, I think it's great. So he is planning. And we, you know, we looked at the pros and the cons, and it sounded like there really were not any cons at all. He may have to stay overnight. And when he spoke to his doctor, the second opinion that he received from another doctor, it was, no, you can just go home after the procedure. And, you know, one of the things that I think was so good is that we can all learn, we can learn from our elders. And I have always felt that it's you're never too old and it's never too late to fall in love. I mean, it may be a little bit more challenging if you're 70 or 80, although if you're an 80-year-old man, it's easier than if you're an 80-year-old woman. I mean, that's certainly for sure. And it's the same thing, you know, with sex. And I've mentioned over the years that when I lived in Sarasota, I had an older clientele. And that I saw many women and many men who were in their 70s and 80s who really had terrific sex lives. You know, whether or not they had ED, whether or not there were some, you know, physical challenges, so to speak. So I am encouraging John to, you know, move ahead with this. As I say, he really did his research in terms of finding a urologist here in New York City who apparently does about 200 procedures every single year. And we looked at the research together. And the majority of men, over 95% of men, were very, very happy that they had actually gone through the procedure to get a penile implant. So, you know, when one thing doesn't work, you move on to the next. And I think that that is one of the challenges in life, whether or not we're talking about depression, anxiety, relationships, or sex. It's really about, you know, staying in the game. And as a former competitive tennis player, you know, I use the analogy is that, you know, it's not over until the last point. So that we have to be creative. We have to be willing to modify things and to change some things, as long as we are really serious about our goals. And of course, athletes. We all have coaches. And, you know, one of the things that I hope that I can convince you and that I've convinced you over the years is that we don't need to navigate the challenges of life on our own. If you can do it with friends, it's great. If you can do it with family members, it's terrific. And if you can't, then you can always reach out to somebody like me. You can reach out to a really, really highly trained and experienced psychotherapist or sex therapist. And then I received a question from a woman. And in the subject line, it was, "Why is my divorce so painful?" And this is the letter. She says, "Beattie, dear Beattie, I'm going through a divorce. And even though I am relieved most days to be out of my marriage," she says, "I initiated the divorce. I'm having a really hard time. I'm not sleeping well, have been having nightmares, have put on a lot of weight, have little energy, poor concentration. And most days, I really don't want to leave my apartment." Well, she's just going through a divorce. It's understandable, even though she initiated the divorce, that she's depressed and disappointing. And we go into our relationships with hopes and dreams that things are really going to work out well. And when they don't, it is depressing. It is depressing. And she says, "Naturally, all of this is affecting my work. What's wrong with me? There is nothing wrong with her. She is certainly, you know, reacting in a normal way. And when am I going to start to feel better?" Her name is Marion. So this is what I say. I said, "Dear Marion, going through a divorce, even though you say your marriage was not a good one, is extremely painful and traumatic." And of course, you know, I cite the divorce statistics, okay? So we need to be aware of the importance of making sure that we really do great assessments, you know, when we are deciding who we are going to want to marry. Again, the divorce statistics for first marriage is 48%. For second marriage is 67%. And for third marriage is 74%. And if you listen to the Ask Beattie Show every single week, you will hear me talking about the three things that we need to do so that we are never going to make a mistake in love again. And first of all, we need to be in a good place ourselves. We need to be emotionally and psychologically in a good place so that we are not looking to have somebody save us. And when we're feeling solid, we are able to look at people, we are able to look at our lives in a much more rational, in a much more careful way. And of course, number two, we need to be students and to be very clear about what the ingredients are that go into a healthy relationship. I still feel that most people don't know. I say this every week, that I think that our educational system really needs to get on board early on and give our kids a proper education that includes relationship education. And then, of course, number three is my book. I wish I'd had this book when I was starting off dating and, you know, really entering into the world of serious relationships. The book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love, teaches people my assessment, my 10-step assessment program. That teaches people really how to assess who's right for you and who's wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. And in a couple of weeks, I'm going to have my friend and colleague, Diana Kirshner, Dr. Diana Kirshner, on the show. And she is a New York Times bestseller. Her book is Finding Love in 90 Days. And we are going to debate that, because my research has found, and my clinical experience with having worked with thousands of people over the years has found, that it takes at least a year using my formula to really find out who somebody is and who somebody is not. And I wish we could fast forward the process, but I have yet to see that this process can really be fast forwarded. So getting back to Marion, you know, I said that it does. It marks when you're ending a relationship, whether or not it's a divorce or whether or not it's a significant relationship, whether or not it's been a short relationship, whether or not it's been a long relationship. It does. It marks the end. It marks the end of our hopes and dreams of spending our life with someone who you once loved and who once loved you. And that is really, really painful. And most people during and after a divorce or the end of a relationship, you know, we find ourselves on an emotional roller coaster ride and like a death. I mean, divorce and the end of a significant relationship, it does. It feels like a death. People go through, and these are normal stages. People go through various difficult stages that include depression, denial, anger, blame, self-blame, why me, and finally acceptance. And this is not just a straightforward path. I mean, I have somebody that I'm seeing right now. Her relationship, she'd been with this man for over 10 years, and it had been a very dysfunctional, very toxic relationship. And finally, he left her a number of months ago, and she has yet to be able to accept the fact that the relationship is over. She still wants to get him back. And I've just actually started to work with her, and I'm hoping, you know, to really help her see how toxic the relationship was. And of course, she needs to understand what her role was in why the relationship continued for so many years. And you know what she has said to me is that she did not want to confront him on anything. He took drugs. He was an alcoholic. He was on the pornography sites. And yet she, in quotes, loved him. And when we really looked at all of that, she was terrified. She was terrified to be alone and chose, like so many people do, to remain in toxic and even violent relationships because the people, the individuals, are not themselves in a good place emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically. So she has some work to do, and it's going to be interesting to see whether or not she's going to finally get to a place to realize, A, that the relationship is over, and it is really over, and to understand the toxicity that she really enabled and encouraged, not blaming her, but that was part of the dynamic that she went along with his disrespect, with his humiliating her, with his simply not being there emotionally and physically. She told me that they would have sex maybe once a year, that she would beg him and beg him to have some physical contact. And there were always excuses. Well, I think the excuses turned out to be affairs and pornography. So, you know, people still, they have a hard time, regardless of how toxic, of how horrible the relationship was. Sometimes, you know, people have a difficult time letting go. And this is where it is really important that people get some some outside help and are able to look in a very introspective way, in a more rational way, to look at what the relationship really was like versus the fantasy and the hope of what we hoped it was going to be like. So again, getting back to Marion here, unfortunately, and this is true, there's no magic way to fast forward the process. And I said to her that the symptoms that you are describing are normal reactions to your painful situation. I mean, she's clearly depressed, but there's different kinds of depression in the mental health field. I mean, there's depression that goes on and on and on, which is called major depression. And then there's a depression that happens as a result of an event, which is called an adjustment disorder. Now, since it just happened, even though I haven't met Marion, I would say that this is more an adjustment disorder, and hopefully that things are going to start to level off for her. And I said that it's very important that you do not let yourself plummet into the depths of despair. And initially, you may need to force yourself, and this is about the doing what is in your best interest, to take a walk, to join a gym, to plan an outing with friends and family, with supportive friends and family, even though this may not be something that you feel that you really want to do. So doing things that are in your best interest, even though you may not have the feeling, you know, the Nike logo, just do it. This absolutely is something that Marion has to take in. So she needs to also, you know, reach out to family and friends, and there's no need to be stoic. She can also join a group. I mean, there are groups for divorced and separated men and women. At least you will be with other people. You'll be able to hear other people's stories. You will be able to hopefully get a lot of support and also insight for yourself. And this is also the time, my friends, for all of you who may be going through breakups to really take care of yourself and not have two bottles of alcohol like the man who I saw yesterday who was having some sexual issues, which of course were exacerbated by the alcohol. So I suggest that you try and do something nice for yourself every single day to pamper yourself. Something that you can look forward to. It may even be on occasion, and I'm not suggesting you have a box of cookies, a decadent cookie, because your body is also stressed, beyond stressed. So you need extra sleep, regular exercise, and good nutrition, because if you continue to suffer from insomnia, you may want to try a natural remedy like maybe melatonin. And if this doesn't help, please, please speak to your doctor about other short-term remedies. And you also have to give yourself permission to express your feelings to others. It is never a good idea to keep your emotions pent up, because doing so really takes its toll on our body and on our psyche. And if you find that talking to friends and family is not sufficient, do yourself a favor and find yourself a really good therapist who can help you deal with your loss, but who can also support you in starting a new chapter in your life. And as I mentioned before, group therapy may also be an option that you may want to consider. And remember, and of course, this is something that I tell you every single week, whether or not you are going through a breakup or not, that asking for help, it is always a strength and not a weakness. And you don't need to do any of this on your own. Now, eventually, just like with my patient, you know, who was in this horrible relationship for all of these years and who continues to want to try to get her ex-boyfriend back, eventually you are going to need to understand what went wrong in your marriage, what went wrong in your relationship, because it's very, very easy to blame your partner, your family. But for those people who've been through divorce, we need to take responsibility for our own part and take an honest look at the role that we played and why our relationships failed. Now, maybe that role was just not speaking up, not confronting, sucking up all kinds of negative emotion, hoping that the upset and the pain and the anger and the things that were not going well, that they were simply going to disappear on their own without having constructive conversations with your partner. And this is something that I suggest all the time to all of us. If you are in a relationship, whether or not it is a marriage, whether or not you're getting to know somebody, whether or not it is a business relationship or a colleague, please do not stuff your feelings. If there is something that needs to be discussed, Don't wait. I mean, I see people, and I've seen couples over the years, they have 10 or 20 or 25 years of unfinished business that they have chosen, okay? They didn't need to, but they have chosen to not deal with. So don't collect the anger and the upset and the pain and the disappointment. And, you know, this woman, she said to me, you know, they never had sex. So I said to her, Did you talk to him about it? She says, well, I would beg him and he would say that he was tired. And I said, so, well, what did you do about that? 1 month was 6 months was 1 year. And she said, look, she said, I just basically gave up and I hoped that miraculously something was going to change on its own. You have to remember, and I think that we all have to remember, that our partners, our colleagues, our children, our families, that nobody is a mind reader. And if we have things, as difficult as it may be to say it, we need to find the time. We need to find the words. We need to find the way to say it well. And this means making appointments and saying to our partners, our colleagues, our bosses, our friends, our family members, look, there's a couple of things that I have been thinking about that have been upsetting to me. And can we set a time and talk about it? Now, in relationships, we can't solve problems on our own, which is why, as unromantic as this may sound, you know, when people ask me all the time, okay, Beattie, you wrote the book, you have your 10-step formula for assessing who's right for you and who's wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. What do you think, Beattie, are the two most important ingredients that actually make or break relationships? And for me, it's key. And I always say, this is not sexy, this is not romantic. But the reality, my friends, is that emotional communication and problem solving, I mean, if we can't communicate well, and if we have partners who are lacking in emotional communication and problem solving skills, the probability of being able to have and maintain a sustained and successful relationship, the probability is not very good at all. So in our relationships, you know, when things end, we have to understand our own role. Did we not take responsibility for expressing our feelings? And so that we need to have as clear as possible an understanding about what went on, what the dynamics were. And I talk about lessons to be learned. I mean, we all go through so many ups and downs in our lives and in our relationships, but hopefully there are lessons that we have learned that we will not repeat in relationships moving forward. And I would not suggest, and it's sometimes tempting, you know, I would not suggest that you drown your sorrows with alcohol and drugs and pills and you know, over-the-counter medications or food. And we got to be realistic that the end of a relationship is so tough, and there's going to be a lot of difficult days and nights, and this is normal, and there is not a quick fix. But the good news, Marion, and to those of you who are in this kind of a situation, is that there is life after divorce. And you should not give up hope that someday, if you choose, you may very well meet a very special person and fall in love again. However, this is no time for a new relationship. You know how so many people you end and you replace and you just kind of go forward without even really taking the time to figure all of this out. And studies show that it takes a minimum of about a year to go through the mourning process. Remember, you are in mourning. This is a death of a relationship. And once you do this, you are going to find that you're going to be emotionally and psychologically and physically and sexually available and ready for a new beginning. Because rebound relationships, I think short term, you know, they may make us feel good and sexy and attractive and wanted and needed, but they usually don't end very well. So this is the time, Marion, and all of you who are in this particular place in your life where your relationships have ended, to take the time and really focus on yourself. There's going to be plenty of time for dating and plenty of time for relationships. And finally, another thing that I think is really important is to not make any major decisions, you know, where you're going to move, a change of job, until you feel that you are on an even keel. But I promise you, because I've been through this, you know, with so many people, including myself in my own life, that each day is going to get better. So that you have to be mindful, you know, the homework that I give my patients every single time they leave, you have to be really, really mindful that whatever it is that you are going to be doing are things that are really and truly in your best interest.